They were roommates. Still, Carr had played a key role in convincing Ned Donnelly that he had plenty of reason to worry about his daughter's claims against him. The doctor stepped in and validated the girl's claims, saying that, in his professional opinion, her recovered memories of abuse were credible. Carr had even put his opinion in writing, in an official-looking document, delivered to Donnelly by his beloved daughter. Carr had performed a similar role in other situations, helping to leverage the backing or silence of individuals who could influence the outcome of Eric's personal liberation plan. So he had let it slide. Ned Donnelly had been shaken that night months ago when he had stumbled into Eric's office. Ned hadn't been much better during subsequent meetings, although the St. Donnelly philanthropist and all-around good guy campaign was going well. His daughter's subsequent disappearance might actually have been a relief to the old guy, except that Carr's affidavit kept the old gent cornered. When his daughter went missing, it was headline news. Eric had Donnelly's back there, too. In a brief televised interview, Ned Donnelly emphasized that he was fully cooperating with police in their investigation into his daughter's disappearance. At his urging, Donnelly offered a substantial reward for information about her whereabouts. Donnelly was devastated by the whole ordeal, having aged 10 years right before Eric's eyes since that first drunken appeal for help. Eric tried to reassure Ned, even going so far as to explain how Shannon's disappearance worked to his advantage, making him more sympathetic in the public eye. Donnelly had taken that the wrong way. Dazed and confused, he left their last meeting without even thanking Eric for the work he was doing. That was okay. Eric didn't need his thanks. His continued cooperation was all that mattered. Score. Eric mentally sank a 3-pointer from mid-court, recalling the exhilaration he'd felt when the votes were in, including Donnelly's thumbs up on the IPO. More jubilation when the lead underwriter was unleashed to preach the good news. Evangelists of greed, they eagerly hit the road to sell, sell, sell public shares of Pinnacle. My kind of guys, Eric chortled to himself in the empty office. If only he could hold it all together. It was a matter of days at this point. Maybe he should have done more when that arrogant bastard Carr went into take-charge doctor mode before the latest mess in Palm Springs. I've got this covered, Eric. No one will find Donnelly before we want her to be found. Libby's gloating about the fact that, with Shannon gone, she's got no competition. That's what she thinks, anyway. He folded his arms and chuffed. What do you mean, that's what she thinks? She'd better not have any competition. Nix the Romeo thing until this is over and you're sitting on some beach somewhere. You'll have all the time and money in the world to chase as many women as you want. Until then, cool it. Even with that Vanderwerp woman. Got it? There's no reason to get worked up about this, Eric. What harm can there be in stringing Libby along at this point? Besides, I'm too old to be Romeo. Casanova, maybe, Dick Carr had said, erupting into guffaws at his cleverness. He had leaned back and put his clasped hands behind his head before going on. Eric had wanted to wipe that grin off his face, but he could wait. Learning there might be other clients with benefits besides Shannon and Libby was infuriating. Still, Carr might have been right about having it all under control, except for Jessica Huntington's meddling. Carr had only mentioned Jessica's name in passing. The name rang a bell, but he'd mistakenly figured she was just another young woman with all the right neuroses and connections to make her a candidate for daddy bashing. He hadn't given her much thought until Carr brought up her name again. As he was about to leave Carr's office, the psychiatrist had finally responded to the admonition about cooling it with Libby. I suppose you're right about Libby, Eric. Jessica Huntington is playing mind games with her. Thanks to that Huntington woman, Libby's having a bout of buyer's remorse. After all I've done for her, too, the ungrateful little minx, she bought into the scheme to take down Daddy and claim what was rightfully hers. So what is her problem? He sensed there was more to the story than Carr revealed. When Eric checked Jessica Huntington out for himself, what he found set his teeth on edge. He knew her name because the woman was a lawyer from a prominent family. Not just any lawyer, but a member of Kennedy, Holmes, Winston, and Klein. Who was one of her clients? The Vanderwerts. It was all too cozy to be coincidental. When he confronted Carr, the Joker admitted he knew about the connection between Jessica Huntington and Libby's parents. He made it quite clear to Libby that Jessica Huntington was working for the other side after Libby had gone to her law office in Palm Desert, right before the sudden surge of conscience. I questioned Libby about the meeting. It was brief and uneventful, so maybe she's just still ticked about Shannon. Women. Who can ever understand them? True, Eric had thought. Carr's eyes were rolling around in his head, so he guessed Carr had been dipping into the samples of pharmaceutical-grade, mind-altering substances kept in a bowl at his office. He left Carr's office grateful that the endgame was underway. Soon, he'd never have to deal with Richard Carr or his ilk again. New questions nagged at Eric now. If Donnelly was taken care of, and the fix was in on Libby Vanderwerp, too, what happened after that? There had to be some reason for the meeting of loose minds up there at the top of the tram. But what? He could feel his blood pressure rising. Let it go, he thought, stretching his neck and shoulders. Another week, two at the most, and it would all be over. No way would the board do anything to disrupt the IPO process. A change in course at this point would shake Pinnacle to its foundations, maybe knock it down altogether. That would happen anyway, but not until after the IPO. The rest of his plan was already in place, too. A simple one. Take the money and run. The jerry-rigging he and the CFO had done to get their S-1 past those desk jockeys at the SEC might not stand up to another round of scrutiny, but it shouldn't have to. The Pinnacle Enterprise financial documents backing up the S-1 were a skillfully written work of fiction. Pinnacle was the mother of all holiday turkeys. A turkey, all right, but one they could sell, raising $1 billion almost overnight. It was lights, camera, action, as the roadshow rolled out before the IPO. Game on. Yes, game, set, and match, Eric said. He slammed his fist down on the desk again. This time, it was an act of triumph. 6. Tiramisu. Frank Fontana had more flowers, a bouquet of bright orange daylilies mixed with sprays of deep blue columbine and other wild flowers. Wild, like the man himself. As usual, his dark brown hair was a little too long. He needed a haircut, but money and time were scarce for the hard-working single father of two. As he dashed into the room, he never took his dark eyes off Jessica, even while giving his cousin Tommy a pat on the back. He nodded to Jerry Reynolds as he leaned in and placed the flowers next to Jessica before bussing her cheek with a kiss. Jessica's heart did a little flip-flop as Frank bent close enough for her to catch a whiff of the outdoors that hung about him. Detective Frank Fontana, with the Riverside County Sheriff's Homicide Division, had no official business with Jessica Huntington. There was plenty of unfinished personal business between them, though. She had sworn there would be no new men in her life for at least a year after divorcing her two-timing ex-husband. The most traumatic aspect of the split was betrayal by a man she'd trusted and pledged to love for a lifetime. For several months now, her mind could stumble upon the ghastly image of Jim's betrayal without wanting to vomit or stomp the man into the ground while wearing 5-inch Jimmy Choos. An awful thing to do to those shoes, she thought. Before Frank retreated, she placed a kiss on the ruggedly handsome detective's cheek. He could use a shave, she thought, as he squeezed her hand. Not that she minded his being a little rough around the edges. In fact, she liked it. An image of her ex floated before her, James Harper, in tennis shoes and a T-shirt, sitting on the floor of their apartment in Palo Alto, his hair shaggy and in need of a shave as they studied together for the bar exam. That image vanished as a more polished but less wholesome version of Jim appeared. This one, clean-shaven and sporting a $300 haircut, was naked, running for his life as Jessica hurled objects at him from their bedroom. The shrieking, silicon-enhanced Hollywood Barbie, his partner in crime, was dashing ahead of him. That image of Jim was sobering. It put a damper on yearnings to find out just what it was about Frank Fontana that smelled so great. In addition to that, she was lying in a hospital bed with a body too banged up to do anything about it, even if she discovered the secret of his allure. "How's she doing?" Frank asked. "I'd ask her, but she'd give me the invulnerable Wonder Woman version, and I want the real scoop." He had a rueful grin on his face, and Jessica stuck her tongue out at him as Jerry answered his question. "Well, I'm sure she thinks she's doing better than she is. It's too soon to know how good a shape she's in. That's why they still have her trapped in here. But I can tell it won't work much longer. She's chomping at the bit to get out of here. Wait until she tells you how she fought off Carr with both hands tied before he and Libby Vanderwerp tossed her off a boulder overlook." That worried look was back on Jerry's face. "I had my hands untied by then. I don't get it, you guys. Miss Marple investigated dozens of heinous crimes, and about the worst thing that ever happened was that she dropped a few stitches in her knitting. Hercule Poirot, the punctilious little detective, almost never had more to complain about than sore feet or getting his spats dirty. Me, I've been punched in the face, thrown to the ground in a parking lot, accosted by gangbangers on the side of the road, kidnapped, drugged, and shot at. Now, to top it all off, I get shoved off a mountain. What am I doing wrong?" "Do you really want me to answer that?" Frank asked, with a glint in his eye, interrupting her rant. She was sure he was about to remind her of the many times he and his counterparts in other homicide units had urged her not to chase cutthroats and let the pros do the dirty work. She had to admit that she'd been ill-prepared to face the onslaught of ugliness vented upon her as she plunged into sleuthing. She thought that was all behind her, until this latest incident caught her off balance. "Hey, I kept my promise not to go after Dr. Carr on my own. That was not my intention when I headed up there to talk to Libby. I also called Detective Hernandez and told him where I was going. Another promise kept, Frank Fontana." He was getting her stirred up, as he often did. The grin on his face said he knew what he was doing. "Ooh, here we go again," Tommy said, shifting his weight on the foot of her bed. It was like he was settling into his seat at the theater. "You realize a lot of this is just sexual tension, right?" Frank laughed, but Jessica and Jerry both shot Tommy a dirty look. Tommy didn't care, as he took full advantage of the special place he held in Jessica's heart. He took delight in taunting her, like a mischievous younger brother, especially about Frank. "What? I can't help it if you heterosexual types require so much foreplay before you..." "Tommy, knock it off," Jerry interrupted, shaking his head. That made Frank laugh louder, and his laughter made Jessica angrier. "Lack of foreplay has nothing to do with it," Jessica blurted. "Wait, that's not what I meant." As they had promised Frank's dad, Jessica and Frank were taking things slow. Since their initial entanglement during the investigation into his cousin Kelly's murder back in June, they'd seen each other regularly, and there had been a few knee-buckling hugs and several tantalizing kisses, but not what you could call foreplay. Okay, so maybe there was some sexual tension between them. What stressed her out more than that were the mixed feelings she had for Frank. The attraction she felt was undeniable. Still, he was a man, and like most men, he could irritate. Some of that was the cop thing. Serve and protect often seemed more like command and control. Then there was the issue of money. It didn't bother her that she had a lot more than he did, but it irked him. Misbegotten male pride, or another aspect of the machismo cop culture. When word got around that they were seeing each other, his cop buddies ribbed him. The classy lady lawyer who clobbered bad guys with expensive smartphones and high heels was renowned countywide among police personnel. That wasn't likely to get any better with all the angel heiress news coverage. "There's too much testosterone in this room. I haven't decided if I even like men very much anymore, gay or straight."
"Does that mean you're thinking about switching teams?"
Tommy had a wicked look on his face. He was blinking and ducking his head like someone might take a swat at him any second.
"You know that's not funny, right?"
Jerry was growing red in the face with anger or embarrassment or both. Even though they were mad about each other, Tommy often pushed Jerry to the brink with his outlandish statements.
that Frank's wife had left him for another woman was the reason for Jerry's distress. "It's not very PC of you either," he added.
"Thomas, you are a brat, and you're getting on my nerves. I just fell off a mountain, for goodness sake. Give me a break. Frank and I are friends. We've made a promise to keep it that way until I can figure out whether I can ever trust anyone, including myself. Maybe it's the last vestiges of the Catholic schoolgirl in me, but I intend to keep that promise."
Jessica made a quick little sign of the cross as she spoke that vow aloud. She stole a look at Frank, who had quit laughing but still had a smirk on his face. She couldn't decide who she wanted to smack more, him or Tommy. Tommy had gone into, what, me? Choir boy mode, playing the innocent as he did so often after he'd stirred things up. The ability to feign a seraphic demeanor was a trait he had shared with his sister, Kelly. She'd kept so much hidden from them, all using that ploy. It didn't work so well for Tommy. Deploying her Jessica Huntington version of the Vulcan mind probe, she penetrated his veil of feigned innocence, and his face drooped.
"I'm sorry. You've been through a lot. It's just that I don't handle the tension."
He must have caught another look from Jerry because he didn't finish the sentence.
"Sorry, Jessica. Sorry, Frank. No offense."
"None taken. It's been over 3 years since Mary switched teams, as you put it. I'm over it. But I keep my promises, too. You might have to put up with more tension since Jessica and I still have a lot of things to sort out. At least for a few more years, I have kids at home. So it's not just me that I have to think about before getting involved with a woman, especially one as stubborn, uppity, and exasperating as our friend here, no matter how lovely and beguiling she can be."
He leaned over and tousled Tommy's hair, as Jerry had done earlier. Jessica felt herself go all mushy inside. They did have a lot of things to sort out, but damn, the man knew how to make it seem worthwhile.
"It's okay. I'm not the only one in this room who's stubborn and exasperating. In fact, I believe that our friend here was about to tell me once again to cool it.
Do I look like I could get into trouble like this?" she asked, holding up her arm with the bandaged hand, free, for the moment at least, from an IV. The other was still in that sling made to support her arm and shoulder and allowed little movement.
"If it were anyone else but you, I'd say not. Your inner Joan of Arc has you ready to believe you can take out bad guys with both hands tied. So why not with one in a sling?"
"That's just not true."
She thought about that moment when she went toe-to-toe with the gun-toting psychiatrist.
"Okay, I shoved him first. The scumbag had a gun pointing right at me."
"Sheesh, that's what I'm talking about.
Look, this is getting us nowhere. Besides checking on your well-being, I stopped by hoping to get the lowdown from you about what happened up there. Pop and his guys will be here, in an official capacity, to ask for a statement any time now. I'd like to hear it myself, off the record, since I have no role in the police investigation. It's more than idle curiosity, though, since you've had me playing consultant on your investigation into Libby Vanderwerp's trouble with her parents."
"Consultant? Woohoo!" Tommy hooted. "That's a fancy term for our Cat Pack snooping activities. I like that."
The Cat Pack was the name she and her friends had adopted for themselves when, like a herd of cats, they had wandered about during their first murder investigation. Less glitz and glam than the 60s Rat Pack that hung out in the Palm Springs area, their strange little band had forged a bond about as strong as that between Sinatra and his chums. They even had a Frank of their own.
"I should remind you about the risk of being too nosy. You know that old saying about curiosity and dead cats. And please don't paw the air or hiss. It just makes me feel worse about anything I do that encourages you to go on with this amateur sleuthing."
"Well, we're not all amateurs," Jerry said. "I'm a card-carrying PI, and it's the way I make a living."
"I'll remind you that Jerry works for me at the firm, most of the time. Okay, often, anyway. And, I might add, Tommy's on the payroll along with Kim Reed as Jerry's assistant. So I suppose that leaves Bernadette and Laura as the amateurs, because Peter's a pro, too."
"Don't forget about Brian.
Are you going to make a case that his barroom bouncer training qualifies him as a pro? He thinks he's muscle, but I sure hope, for his sake, he doesn't give up his day job.
Now, don't pick on my poor pool boy. He's not even here to defend himself. For your information, Peter has taken the guy under his wing, hoping to give him a little security training to go with that well-intentioned brawn of his.
Frank's mouth popped open, but no words came out.
Brian and Peter? Are you sure about that?
Frank still seemed incredulous when he finally spoke.
Yep. Brian has been doing ride-alongs, and he's taking a course to get the basic training he needs for a California Guard card. I guess Peter's company does that thing. Offers training certified by the Bureau of Security and Investigative Services.
Now Jerry wore a befuddled expression, too.
What? Jessica asked.
That's it, isn't it, Jerry? B-S-I-S?
Oh, yeah, you've got that right. It's just that I'm about as surprised as Frank about the ride-alongs. Brian gets on Peter's nerves. I can't imagine them in the same car together for long without an incident.
Brian gets on everyone's nerves. Even our sweet, patient St. Bernadette gets pushed to the point where I think she'll take a rolled-up newspaper to him. He's like a big, hyperactive dog underfoot. But he means well, and Peter's of the opinion that discipline and training will do him a world of good.
Woof, woof.
Jerry and Frank both glared at Tommy.
Nothing wrong with discipline. In the right hands.
Oh, stop it. These guys will sign you up for obedient school, too, if you keep that up, Tommy.
Promise?
Do I get to wear a collar? Tommy asked, panting like a dog.
Jerry blushed and rolled his eyes at Tommy's antics. It was Jessica's turn to be puzzled.
Now I'm lost, Tommy. What are you babbling about?
Shades of gray, Jessica.
What planet are you on?
Oh, yuck. You too? We've spent the last 50 years trying to get women out of bondage, way over 50 shades of it, and one hyped-up book makes it chic to put them back in it. Not to mention all the effort that's gone on to try to help people sort out the boundaries between sex and power. There is nothing sexy about being bound. I know what I'm saying. My wrists are still sore from my latest stint in ropes. See?
Speak for yourself. You know, for me, it has nothing to do with women. But point taken. Maybe you need to stop with all the whipped puppy stuff.
Tommy stared at the floor with a sad look on his face, feeling sorry for himself most likely after having been scolded. 10 seconds later, he made whiny puppy sounds, grinning as he settled into a nearby chair. Jessica felt her embattled nervous system getting riled up.
Don't make me tattle to Bernadette about you.
That shut him up. He believed that the saintly Bernadette possessed special powers.
She'll call forth the hounds of hell. Then what will you do, smarty pants?
Jessica asked as she turned her attention back to the matter at hand.
Gentlemen, I've had about all I can take for one afternoon, speaking of tension and getting on people's nerves. I love you all. I mean that in the truest sense of the word, catpack esprit de corps and all of that. As you can see, Frank, I am doing fine. If you will all shut up for a few minutes, I'll give you the rundown on what happened with Libby. After that, you can all go, so I can get my beauty sleep. Since Bernadette isn't here, I'll call Nurse Andrews, and we'll see what an empowered woman can do without any props.
Jessica spent the next 20 minutes going over, once again, what happened the day before at the top of the tramway. Frank asked Jessica several clarifying questions, but otherwise, the men in the room kept silent. Jessica told the story in a more coherent way this time, but that didn't mean it made more sense.
So, here's the big picture. Carr was treating both Libby and Shannon, and he was up to no good, Jessica said, concluding her account.
What kind of no good still isn't clear, although at least some of it involved an inappropriate sexual relationship with Libby. Even if Libby has evidence of an affair, I find it hard to believe he'd kill her because of it. That means there's more going on. Given Libby's rambling, it could be related to Shannon Donnelly's disappearance. I don't have a good feeling about that. Libby also said all Carr wanted was the money she was trying to extort from her parents by making false allegations against them. Maybe Libby wasn't the only client scamming her parents.
While sexual indiscretion isn't a crime, blackmail is. If he was using his clients to get a share of their ill-gotten gains, and Libby or Shannon had proof, it might be a motive for murder. Libby seems to know what happened to Shannon, so maybe that's why Carr planned to kill her, and me too, if he thought Libby had told me about Shannon. I'm not sure where the Red Devil fits into all of this. Arg! You guys are right. I'm too worn out to figure this all out. I need to back off.
You're fortunate to have survived that ordeal. If I can believe that what you intend to do is take it easy, I'll rest easier too, and I won't go waving my badge at you. What's the point of having this crack team of Cat Pack consultants if you don't use them? What I propose is that you let us pick up the trail from here for a few days while you recover. I'll run interference for you with Dad and his colleagues at the Palm Springs Police Department to give you another day or two before they interrogate you. That also means that when they question you, they get the whole story. No shielding Libby out of an overdeveloped sense of loyalty to her parents. If you care about them, you'll give the police every shred of information you have, even if it raises suspicions about their daughter.
It's a deal. Thanks for giving me a little more breathing room. I sure would like to know whether that blue bag or suitcase exists and what's in it. Maybe the Cat City police have enough on Libby as a suspect in Donnelly's disappearance, and they can get a warrant to search her place in Los Angeles.
If you tell Hernandez what you've learned, it might make that happen. That's presuming they haven't already done it. Or maybe Pop and his guys can get someone to do it. It's likely Libby's involvement in Carr's death, whether they charge her with murder or involuntary manslaughter, will give them a reason to do a thorough investigation.
Unless they decide she acted in self-defense.
Okay, so maybe voluntary manslaughter then. That still means a formal police investigation. My point is, here's another chance to let the process run its course while you get back on your feet.
I hear you. There are all these little snippets of conversation with Libby that pop into my head at odd moments, little details that nag at me. Like, how did the press get hold of the idea that Carr was treating Libby? That's confidential information, so how did it get into the hands of the press?
That's a good question.
Jerry took out the small notebook he always carried with him and made a notation in it.
We'll track down the reporters and ask where that information came from. Don't hold your breath about getting a clear answer, though.
She leaned back against the pillow and closed her eyes. Did I tell you it hurts to talk, you guys? If I suck in air the wrong way, I pay a penalty. My body is telling me to back off, too.
Good. Not because you're in pain, but because you're paying attention to the messages your body is sending you. It's a lovely one, and worth the attention. I can vouch for that.
He smiled, affection softening his dark brown eyes, and shyness stealing over him at the words he had just spoken. This more vulnerable version of Frank Fontana was the one she found irresistible. Kind and thoughtful, he often expressed care and tenderness toward his children and parents, displaying a depth she couldn't remember ever having seen in her ex-husband. How odd she hadn't noticed, until too late, that Jim's relationships with others were shallow and self-serving.
"Well, it's the only one I've got," she said, as their eyes met.
"Get some rest."
Visibly relieved when she nodded in agreement, Frank moved closer. He picked up the flowers he'd set on the bed next to her and dropped them into the water pitcher on a tray beside her bed. Jessica must have looked askance.
"Don't worry. I'll take full responsibility with Nurse Andrews. I'll ask her to bring you a new pitcher and more water on my way out. Promise."
With that, he leaned over and kissed her lightly on the lips. The sensation provoked a different set of messages from her body. Not one of them told her to back off. Jessica watched the man leave the room, swagger in his step, as he went off to battle with Nurse Andrews. Jerry and Tommy left, too, after planting friendly smooches on her face. They said something as they left, but her mind was too full of Frank Fontana to process it.
"Don't tell me that's not foreplay," Tommy hollered from the doorway, a devilish grin back on his face.
Jessica drifted into a dreamy state. Nurse Andrews entered the room with a fresh pitcher of water.
She poured a cup of water and offered it to Jessica, along with some pills.
Your friend said you're feeling some pain. It's time for your afternoon meds, so this should do the trick. If not, let me know, and I'll call the doctor for you. He made me promise to take good care of you.
She smiled for a moment before the sight of those flowers in the water pitcher wiped it away. Picking up the old pitcher, she put the new one in its place. Jessica thought she heard the nurse utter a quiet harumph as she found a spot in the room for Frank's flowers. That Frank kept his promises was another striking difference between him and the well-heeled heel she had married. As she drifted toward sleep, she reveled in pleasant memories of another promise Frank had kept. In August, Frank cooked Jessica one of the best Italian dinners she'd ever eaten. A peacekeeper in the family, he had been at his Irish mother's side when his Italian grandmother and aunts taught her to cook all the Fontana family favorites, not the kind of meals they had eaten in Italy, but the meals that had become customary in Italian immigrant households. The centerpiece of the meal was pasta, spaghetti cooked al dente, and then covered with salsa di pomodoro, simmered to add depth to the rich tomato flavor. Garlic and fresh herbs enriched the sauce. Frank served small meatballs on the side. They were made from a mixture of ground beef, veal, and pork, and flavored with a hint of nutmeg, parsley, garlic, and Parmesan cheese. Frank called the appetizer that began their meal bagna cauda. It was like the crudité featured with many restaurant meals. Crusty chunks of bread, blanched asparagus, cauliflower, and carrots set out with a warm dip. A luscious concoction of salty anchovies, garlic, and olive oil, blended and then warmed. Not a fan of the anchovy, Jessica had been dubious when he described the ingredients as he placed the fare in front of her. My effort to keep up with trends in Italian cooking, Frank had offered, as he set a tiny bowl of mixed olives beside the bagna cauda. The olives were warm and laced with sprigs of rosemary, crushed red pepper, and lemon zest.
Oh, my God, Frank, this is to die for, Jessica had exclaimed after tasting the bagna cauda.
I won't tell Bernadette you said that. I want her to continue to like me.
Frank, what are you saying? The only thing you have to worry about is getting recruited to step in and help feed our little cat pack.
Their group had added new members during that awful summer. Not just Frank Fontana, but Kim Reed had joined their ranks. When Jessica met Kim Reed, she was the office manager for a prime suspect in their investigation into Kelly Fontana's death. Kim had been helpful in determining who killed her dear friend, Tommy's sister, and Frank's cousin.
This is an experiment for both of us, Frank had said, breaking into Jessica's reverie.
A note of anxiety was in his voice as he placed a side dish of artichoke gratinata next to the hand-painted earthenware pasta bowl containing her spaghetti. His face lit up with delight when Jessica let out a little sigh after tasting a bite.
This is amazing, too, Frank. Keep on experimenting, she said, before stuffing another bite of the delicious food into her mouth. Not very demure, but what the heck, she thought, as she savored the crispy breadcrumbs atop warm artichoke hearts. The dish melted in her mouth.
You know the way to a woman's heart, she mumbled between bites.
I sure hope so, he said, a flirty grin on his face. Can I ply you with more of this obscenely delicious wine you brought to share?
She nodded as she continued to shove food into her mouth. Thinking about that night now, it wasn't just the food that had captivated her. True, the meal added a sensual quality to the evening, as did the 2001 Corazon Kronos Vineyard Cabernet that Jessica had brought to the table. A perfect addition, the wine was vividly aromatic, cassis-scented, and had dramatic color and legs in the glass. It rolled over the tongue with grace, bursting with flavors of dark cherry and oak. One of the last bottles she and her ex-husband had bought as a couple, her enjoyment was more evidence that Jim Harper was becoming a less painful part of her past. The companionship was welcome. Not all their get-togethers were fraught with tension and disagreement. Their meal had been a leisurely one, uninterrupted by Frank's kids, Evie and Frankie. They were with their two moms for the weekend. Mary, Frank's ex, had remarried. Her new wife was a cop, and his former co-worker in the sheriff's department. He had his own healing to do from a marriage that had come undone when he discovered his wife and his colleague were having an affair. The thing that Jessica found most touching about that whole evening was the care that Frank had taken with the meal. The man worked endless hours as a homicide detective with the Riverside County Sheriff's Department and had two kids underfoot much of the time. He and his ex-wife shared custody, but they spent most of their time with him while school was in session. That he had planned and shopped and cooked such a splendid dinner had called that adage to mind about the connection between food and love. They had taken their dessert, vanilla gelato covered in a light lemony sauce, out to the back patio at his home in Paris, 60 miles east of Rancho Mirage. The evening was cool by desert standards and offered a welcome change. So did Frank. His eagerness to please and apparent openness was a pleasant change from her ex, who had grown more self-absorbed and remote before their marriage ended. Jim Harper had seemed so right. He had money of his own when they married, so she believed money would not come between them. Wrong. Jim wanted more. At some point, his insatiable lust for more had become an overwhelming drive, almost obsessive. As she learned the hard way, that lust had extended beyond money to encompass other prerogatives of a master of the universe, including a trophy wife straight from the big screen. The second Mrs. James Harper was a double-D pin-up girl to adolescent males everywhere, many disguised as adult men. All of that weighed down upon her as she sat with Frank that night, and as she thought about it again after he sauntered out of the hospital room. It was still too soon to take their relationship further. There was also the little matter of a gentleman by the name of Paul Worthington. Despite her best efforts to stay away from men in the wake of Jim's betrayal, there were two intriguing men in her life. Paul Worthington, a cool, blue-eyed blonde on the verge of middle age, was, in some ways, Jim all grown up, but in a good way. Born to money, he was mature and intelligent. His good traits were many. A stand-up guy, unspoiled by the wealth and power he commanded as a senior associate with a Vault 100 law firm. So handsome, too. The fragrance of bergamot and amber hung about him. That scent, Jessica had discovered, was a Caswell Macy product that he always wore. Not cologne, but shampoo, soap, gel, or something like that. A light citrusy fragrance with an undercurrent of something richer, like lemon meringue pie, Jessica muttered as she slid toward sleep. Frank Fontana was a different story. Warm apple pie, or maybe tiramisu. Jessica giggled at the thought of characterizing the two men as delectable desserts. I'd better see about getting those meds cut back. That was her last thought before she drifted off for a nap. Until Nurse Andrews brought her dinner, and dessert stood at the foot of the bed with his blue eyes sparkling. 7. Lemon Meringue Pie. Jessica struggled to focus and drive ideas about men as desserts out of her mind. What to do about their relationship was troublesome enough when it came to Paul Worthington. Drooling over him as he sat there would not be helpful. Money issues were not a problem, since Paul could hold his own with her on that front. No one would mock him for taking up with a wealthy woman, as some of Frank's buddies did. She and Paul had a lot more in common than their wealth. Not just the law. They shared a love of theater and cinema. In particular, film noir classics. There was their love of opera, art, architecture, and travel, too. They both enjoyed many of the good things that money could buy, with none of the awkwardness or embarrassment she sometimes felt around Frank. Not that Paul shared her spendthrift tendencies. He didn't enjoy shopping, as she and her ex had, and as Jessica continued to do, despite vows to stop. Paul was kind, generous, and full of surprises. The dashing lawyer could dance. Jessica loved to dance, and early in their marriage had forced Jim to go dancing with her. But Paul didn't need to be forced into anything. Light on his feet and great in the clinches, he could keep up with her at the foxtrot, waltz, samba, and tango. Like Jessica, he'd taken dance year after year, along with etiquette classes. Unlike many males in that situation, Paul had loved it. As Jessica soon learned, in dance, the reticent side of the man gave himself over to the moment. Those moments enthralled Jessica, like that first night, dancing under the stars at the celebration for Hank. She found herself swept up in an exhilaration she hadn't experienced while dancing with Jim or anyone else. There was more to Paul than met the eye, although that was plenty. As he gazed at her, his blue eyes filled with concern, she tried not to think about lemon meringue pie or those moments spent in his arms. The two of them pressed together, moving in sync to the rhythms of whatever music was playing. Two things kept her from abandoning herself to those moments. The slashes of betrayal left by Jim Harper, and the fact that Paul Worthington was her boss. She also felt a little guilty about Frank.
"Hey, sleepyhead," Paul said, as she shook off the remnants of her nap. "How are you doing?"
"Okay, considering I fell off a mountain," she said, still trying to make herself believe it. Jessica struggled to put up as much of a professional front as she could from a hospital bed, despite wearing bandages and a cast.
"You're so lucky to be alive,"
he said, using almost the exact words Frank had used earlier and using the same worried, chiding tone in his voice.
"Not just the fall, but also because Libby had a gun. It sounds like she finally went off the deep end, if you'll pardon the expression, under the circumstances. Her parents have been telling her for years she would eventually get herself into trouble they couldn't help her fix. From what I've heard, this just might be it."
"I know. Not just Libby. Her charming shrink had a gun, too. I can see how Dr. Carr might have passed as sane to get his mitts on a handgun. But Libby? I find it hard to believe she'd get through a background check." She shook her head. Then she spent the next few minutes telling the story once again. She ended up back at the point Paul had made about a gun. Who knew she was packing heat? That must be a probation violation. What was she thinking?
"Her probation ended a little while ago. She didn't wait long before getting into more trouble, did she? The gun isn't her only problem now, with kidnapping and maybe murder charges looming. That gun will put her on the fast track for maximum prison time if she's convicted."
"Using it to kidnap me was a spur-of-the-moment thing. She was scared and convinced someone was following her, so I presume she brought it with her as protection. Until Carr showed up armed with a gun, I thought she was delusional, paranoid, or attention-seeking. Kidnapping and murder never entered my mind, at least not my conscious mind, when I agreed to meet her up there. On some level, I thought it was a good idea to tell Detective Hernandez where I was going and who I was meeting, so maybe I sensed she was dangerous. The odd thing, one of them, anyway, is how surprised Libby was to see Carr when he turned up. Who did she imagine was stalking her if Carr's presence was a surprise?"
"That's an excellent question. I'm sure the police will ask if she recovers enough for them to question her. She could have been surprised by the fact that he had that gun, especially if she had lured Carr up there to kill him. Jealousy is an all too common reason to kill. It could be she was angry enough about not being the only psycho tramp in the man's life to kill him. That's a new one. Psychotramp is a term I haven't heard before. Maybe she planned a murder-suicide until Carr showed up with that gun. If it turns out the gunshot is what killed him, there's a case to be made for self-defense, with the two of them wrestling over that gun as you described it."
The defense attorney wheels in his head were turning. Libby's fear appeared genuine, but there's no way to rule out the possibility that her paranoia about being followed was delusional. Maybe part of a bigger delusion about a conspiracy behind Shannon Donnelly's disappearance involving a red devil.
"It sounds crazy, that's for sure. She didn't conjure up Dr. Carr, though."
"True, and I can vouch for the fact that he had murder on his mind, so the self-defense issue was legitimate. I think that surprised her, too. He wasn't just armed, but intent on killing her. In those moments, her reactions seemed more unguarded than they had been in the hours before Dr. Demento stepped out of the shadows. Why tattle on Carr and tell me she had evidence to nail him for malpractice if she was just going to kill him anyway?"
"I hear what you're saying. If she didn't lure him up there, how did he know where to find her?"
he asked, A chill passed between them, perhaps both thinking about that Red Devil comment Libby had made. I'm not sold on the idea he was in league with a devil, but I suppose Carr could have had a partner who was following Libby and keeping tabs on her. If she had spotted the person tailing her, that would explain her paranoia. That doesn't tell us why Carr was after her himself and with a gun. Another possibility Jerry and I talked about earlier today is that Libby does know something that implicated Carr in Sharon Donnelly's disappearance. That's what she said she wanted to talk about when she called me, but she never got around to telling me very much. It's too bad she wasn't more forthcoming with specific information about what kind of trouble she caused for Shannon with Carr and his Red Devil sidekick. I wish we had news for Shannon's father. I saw Ned Donnelly at a holiday charity event for the L.A. Philharmonic this week. He looked grim. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised to learn that he's gone through as much with his daughter as the Vanderwerts have with Libby. It's enough to make you never want to have children. Can there be that many deranged daughters roaming around? You know the answer to that better than I do. I'm sure you've seen more than most, given your experience as a defense attorney for the rich and famous. Not just their daughters, either. Look at those Menendez brothers. Who knows if they're deranged, spoiled, or bad seeds? You raise an interesting point, though, about Ned Donnelly. If Libby's telling the truth, both she and Shannon were seeing Dr. Carr at his office and in more intimate settings. Carr bragged that his 90210 princesses were easy to manipulate. Maybe that applied to Shannon Donnelly, and he was using her to extort money from her parents, too. I don't suppose her father would have disclosed that to the police investigating her disappearance. When Hernandez met with the Vanderwerts and me, he was focused on finding out what he could about Libby's relationship with Shannon and her whereabouts when Shannon went missing. He didn't ask about the relationship between Libby and her parents, so the Vanderwerts and I were tight-lipped about Libby's accusations. It seemed unrelated. If Shannon Donnelly was Libby Vanderwert's psychic doppelganger, maybe her parents have been going through the same nightmare. Psychic doppelganger. Okay, that's a new one, too. You're right. It's not the kind of trouble the Donnellys would volunteer if the police didn't pry. Both Shannon and Libby are grown women in their 30s, not minors who might have run away from home. You could ask Detective Hernandez to go back to Ned Donnelly and do a follow-up, but then you'd have to reveal more about what's going on between Libby and her parents to interest him in the idea. Given Libby's confessions to you about making false allegations and the tie-in to Carr, you should include that in your statement to the police anyway. Withholding that kind of information could impede the investigations involving both Libby and Shannon. You don't need to go into the grimy details, but you need to say something about the allegations and extortion efforts by Libby and lover boy Carr. I'll touch base with Nick and Nora and fill them in on what you've told me. That will save you the stress of telling your story all over again to them. Although at some point, they may have questions for you. I'll explain that your statement to the police will include basic information about the latest round of trouble with their daughter. The level of emotion evident in Paul's remarks baffled Jessica. Sorry. I know you feel bad for them. This is another fine mess I've gotten us into, isn't it? Not that I'm sure how I instigated a change of heart on Libby's part, as Carr claimed. I didn't deliberately try to trigger a bout of the scruples. You don't need to apologize. This isn't about anything you've done. A woman as mercurial as Libby might have had a change of heart for many reasons. Maybe she got up one morning, heard a particular song on the radio, and missed her parents. Or, more likely, experienced a bout of self-pity about being alienated from the parents she drove off, you know? Since when is remorse a bad thing? Good for you if you gave Libby a good jolt and evoked a shred of decency. I'm just glad you don't blame me for putting you in the path of that psycho tramp, or whatever label she prefers. You're right that I've seen more unprincipled and ungrateful children than I care to think about. Most of the time they wait until the parents are older, on their deathbeds or in the grave, before they make their grab for the gold, which doesn't make it any less diabolical. Not to worry, Paul. My heart goes out to the Vanderwerts, and I'm glad to be in their court. Let's hope it's not a real court, though. Maybe it is diabolical, and Libby is possessed. That makes about as much sense as any other explanation for her behavior. There were times when she was hissing like a snake, in between howling and other antics. No vomiting up green slime or head spinning around backwards like the girl in that old Exorcist movie. Jessica shuddered, recalling the glint in Libby's eyes as she waved that gun around with her hair blowing around her, Medusa-like. Paul frowned as he let Jessica ramble on. This is getting to him, he thought, wondering if there was something personal about it. Paul, I'm kidding about the whole Exorcist thing. I feel awful that you have to follow up with the Vanderwerts, adding that to your to-do list. This has been a setback, just when I was hoping I might make a run at matching your pace as a lawyer. Don't worry. You've already exceeded my expectations since we opened that office. I just got a call from Leslie Windsor. She was worried about you. She loves the house you helped her purchase out here and the community it's in so much that she helped her mother move out here into another country club. That hasn't worked out as well for Mom, and she's in the middle of a brouhaha with members of her own homeowners association. Anyway, Leslie has referred her mother to you, so your hard work is still paying off, even while you're in here. I'm just sorry she had to call you about the brouhaha. Jessica struggled to hang on to a professional demeanor. Paul reached out and put a reassuring hand over hers. The tingle that ran through her didn't help her feel more professional, nor did the softness that had filled those blue eyes, the tender smile on the man's sensuous lips, the curve of his chin, the wave in his hair, or the way his tie needed adjusting. "Down, girl," she commanded herself. There must be a disinhibiting effect of the drug she was on that had her emotions rampaging, especially when there was a deliciously handsome man nearby. Everyone faces setbacks, more likely from the flu than a shove off a mountain, I'll give you that. It's the holidays, and everyone's preoccupied with the season. Our offices are scheduled to be closed for a few days. When you're feeling better, you'll have time to get caught up. You have about the best bad luck I've ever seen, he said, shaking his head. Trust me, I've seen plenty of wrong place, wrong time scenarios, and you are so fortunate to have landed where you did when you did. He smiled. That smile was reassuring and helped her regain her composure. Don't let Detective Hernandez hear you say that. He'll lecture me on the dark side of kismet. I once made the mistake of using that term around him, and he hasn't let me forget it. I'm sure I'll get another visit from him any minute now, too. Paul gave her hand a squeeze, sending her into lemon meringue pie territory again. My point is that things at the office will be just fine. Amy's got your back. She's already rescheduled your meetings. You two make a crack team, and Kim Reed has turned out to be a phenom, according to Amy. Kim will keep working on the routine things you've assigned her to do. If you're not out of here in another day or two, Amy will stop by and go over everything with you here. Do as you're told so you can get back on your feet quickly. We've got more dancing to do, you know? Much more, I hope. Okay, boss, she said, gulping as she spoke. I won't always be your boss. In fact, as soon as this office is up and running, in another year or so, my plan is to step out of the role. She must have looked alarmed or shocked. What? I'm not leaving the firm. I just won't be your boss anymore. Heck, by then, you could be running the place. It will be up to the firm to decide who to put in my place, though. It's part of my overall plan to bring balance into my life. I want more room for other things. For people. The blue in his eyes deepened, pulling her into them. She realized how sad it would be not to have him around. Granted, he wasn't at the office every day, but at least two or three times each week. The place came alive with the force of his presence. Jessica fought a teary sensation as Paul spoke again. It's too soon to retire, but not too soon to dream about it and plan for it. I'm thinking of buying something out here in the desert, and that's another reason for you to get back up on your feet. After the holidays are over, I want to check out places. I could use your help if you don't mind. You know so much more about the area and have some idea of my taste in architecture and style. Will you give me a hand? His hand was still resting on her free hand, and Jessica's fingers, almost of their own accord, linked with his, but she let go as soon as she realized what she'd done. Of course I will, she said, as the man stood up to leave. Here's looking at you, kid. He chucked her on the chin as he uttered that line from Casablanca, one of their favorite old films they had watched together. So, lemon meringue pie or tiramisu, what was it going to be?
Whoa, baby, I'd better figure this out before someone gets hurt, she thought, as Paul shut the door behind him.
8. A crutch. Alexis lay on her bed in the glamorous master bedroom that had once been the room she shared with Hank Huntington. It was a strange but familiar sensation, being back in this house with him in a guest room nearby. They had relied on such an arrangement before, many times. Then, as now, it had been the way they coped with shared parenting duties as their marriage deteriorated and then dissolved. And here they were again, reunited under one roof, because of Jessica. Her head still hurt, even after taking Xanax to relax and OxyContin to kill the pain. She should cut back, and had vowed she would. The doctors wanted to schedule surgery for a hysterectomy, and had put it off several times when her blood work came back loaded with the kind of drugs that make a general anesthetic risky, especially for a woman in her 60s, as her gynecologist pointed out.
You're not a young woman anymore. The drugs are taking a toll. Weight loss, elevated blood pressure, and an irregular heartbeat. Your liver's not looking so good either.
Her gynecologist, the one female in the portfolio of doctors managing Alexis's health care, had been gently reproachful. She was one of the first doctors Alexis consulted after the routine pap exam in L.A. revealed trouble. In August, Dr. Kate Mendel confirmed the diagnosis of early-stage cervical cancer. Then, like the physician in Beverly Hills, she reassured Alexis it was a cancer that could be contained. Her gynecologist recommended surgery and set up consults with local surgeons and an oncologist. Despite the trouble with Jessica, Alexis had kept her follow-up appointment this morning. Now, over 3 months later and still in limbo about what to do next, her gynecologist made another suggestion. Perhaps if she couldn't wean herself off all the tranquilizers and pain meds alone, it was time to get some help. She knew what she meant before the woman could say Betty Ford. She'd been down that road before, and sobriety was a bitch. Given all that was going on in her life, she hesitated to face it without chemical enhancements, nor was she in any position to do a stint at Betty Ford. Not that she needed that kind of help anyway. She just needed her life to settle down. You can't put this off much longer. While the cancer is at an early stage and treatable, it's still cancer. This isn't the first time we've talked about a hysterectomy. You've had problems with fibroids for years, and the surgery would give you relief. I don't want to be too dramatic, but major surgery is never free of risk. With all the drugs you're on... Alexis had quit listening at that point.
Pay attention, you wretched girl, her mother's voice had chided.
Alexis had mumbled something signifying acquiescence. All she wanted to do was get out of there, then go home and take a few pills. The thought of giving up the pills just made her want to take more while she could, like binging before going on a diet. She had done that a few times, too, before pills mattered more than food. When she returned home from her doctor appointment, she checked with Hank and Bernadette, who were still waiting for news from the hospital about Jessica's release. The previous night, when they had returned to the hospital after dinner, it had been a relief to find Jessica much improved. Their spirits had soared at the sight of her, propped up in bed, speaking with a handsome visitor. Paul Worthington greeted them as he left the hospital room. He shook hands with Hank and chatted for a moment about the projects Hank had underway. Paul was familiar with Hank's work and had helped to support the gala honoring him. As the two men spoke, Alexis realized why she held Paul in such high regard. He was a lot like Hank, amiable, intelligent, direct, and hard-working, perhaps too hard-working, which might explain how the tall, rich, good-looking blonde was still unmarried at 40. A catch for her daughter, but more than that, a real chance at happiness with a man as forthright as Hank. Jessica was watching the two men, her head cocked to one side, as Alexis sat down beside her. Alexis was glad that Jessica didn't see she had wobbled as she sat, not quite hitting the seat as planned. She chided herself for having that last glass of wine before leaving home and hoped she could keep it together for Jessica's sake. She stifled a giggle at the thought of hitting the floor instead of that chair. It wouldn't be good if another Huntington woman, well, ex-Huntington woman, took a fall. When she looked up, Bernadette